Well, you think you know everything about Roswell, New Mexico? Well, I'm not quite for sure about that, unless you read the books of my today's guest. And even then, new information might have revealed itself since the covering of this book. 75 years ago this year, an alien ship, along with passengers, was discovered in a field on a ranch outside of Roswell, New Mexico. Later, the United States Air Force says, oh, it's just a weather balloon with test dummies on board. Well, Thomas Carey and Donald Schmidt were not satisfied with this answer, so they came together and wrote two best-selling books, Witness to Roswell and Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case, Closed. And if there are questions still unanswered, I'm sure these two will eventually be able to find out. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios Thomas J. Carey and Donald R. Schmidt, UFO investigators and best-selling authors.
Nice to be with you.
Hello, hello. Well, who brought the beer?
Well, that'd be Tom.
Oh, okay.
Well, like the good laughter.
Well, first of all, you know, I can't believe that this year in July is going to be the 75th anniversary. They're going to be celebrating it in the crash of the UFO in Roswell. And I'm excited that you guys are going to be there. I'm going to be there myself. We're going to be interviewing bunches of speakers down there. But a lot has happened since you guys released your books. You know, there's always somebody loosening their lips and talking about family secrets. And so I wanted to start off, before we jump backwards, if there's any new information since your book was released, is there any new information about the Roswell itself?
New information since when is this, Tony?
Well, your book, like Witness, since you wrote Witness to Roswell and the other Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case, has there been any new information from family members or anybody like that?
There's always new information, unfortunately. Off the top of my head, I would have to think about it, because we put a lot of new information in the book. And let Don shoot for that one. I'm going to be thinking, okay. Thinking about, I mean, because we did put a lot of new information in the book, and especially where they were from. We now have a good idea where the crash originated.
Really?
I'm not going to tell you because we want the people to buy the book.
Okay.
It's in the book.
That's what you call a teaser, people.
Yes. Well, that's my teaser.
That's his teaser. Okay, on a number of fronts. One of the things we obviously were able to determine very early on was there were multiple flights that came in, and then also flights that departed from Roswell, either transporting wreckage or bodies. And one of the things that slowly developed through the years was that, as we had personally discovered, that there was a freight yard outside the East Gate, which just happened to be across from the very tarmac from the very hangar P3, now right. called Building 84, where all the wreckage and the bodies had actually transited through. So this would enable, you know, all the activity to essentially bypass the base proper, that they could load aircraft, or in this case, they could go through the East Gate and load up one of the freight cars. Well, we had tracked down the son of the very civil service supervisor who managed the freight yard at that time. And putting two and two together, we discovered that there was a truck that transported debris through that East Gate and loaded up one of the very freight cars, which was then to head out east, and obviously the final destination, Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. Well, we then managed to track down one of the very MPs who came in from outside of Roswell, who was assigned to be part of that unit. And then we learned of an engineer who was involved at Timken, which was a ball bearing factory, which at the time had one of the hottest blast furnaces in the world. And they had major contracts with the military at that time. And in the book, we describe how there were major scientists who some in two cases were regarded as two of the main metallurgists in the world at that time. Hmm. And they just happened to work at Timken.
Hmm.
And so putting this all together, it just was amazing that we're able to establish that paper trail, that not only do you have men who loaded up the freight car, you have a, as far as a civil servant supervisor who observed the and supervised the loading of that cargo, then that train going on to Ohio, and before its final destination at Wright Field, that Timken was, they unloaded a number of boxes there at that ball bearing factory, and obviously to test the materials from Roswell in one of the blast furnaces. So, I mean, this was, you know, a story that we had only been tinkering with for a number of years, and then to see it all come together with multiple firsthand witnesses from different vantage points. And so it just always continues to demonstrate that these people are all reading from the same script.
Right.
Or they're just quite simply reporting what they observed from their vantage point, from their angle of involvement. And it's amazing in that they're not discrediting, they're not contradicting, they're not arguing with, well, no, I was on that flight. Oh, no, I'm, you know. It was interesting is there is a 509th of the 509th bomb wing, a historian by the name of John Custer Mellon. And he wrote a book on the atomic bomb, and he had interviewed like Paul Tibbetts, who flew Enola Gay, and he interviewed Chuck, Colonel Chuck Sweeney,
right,
who flew Boxcar. And he said, Don, you'd be amazed how many men claimed they were on those two flights.
Wow.
Who weren't. That they were all trying to take credit that they were on those two flights that dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. Well, it doesn't discredit those flights. It doesn't discredit the fact that the very, you know, bombs were dropped on Japan. It's just that you have that many people debating and arguing as far as their involvement. We don't have that with Roswell. Tom would agree that it's where they all come together, pieces of this puzzle, this mosaic. And as I said, they're either all reading from the same script or they're describing precisely what they know to be the truth.
And what was the furnaces? What did they... The results did they find out with the metal itself?
Well, quickly, and before that time, Tom, chime in.
Yeah.
According to the eyewitness there, the heat had absolutely no effect.
Mm.
And that there was no flash point. There was no melting temperature, at least that the blast furnace was able to, like 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and that it had no effect on this material. And again, that's consistent with all the testing described to us at Roswell,
right,
at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. We have descriptions from one of the welding shops that just happened to be down the road from the front gate at Roswell. And some of the enlisted men were sneaking out pieces of the material with the hope that either an acetylene torch or even a welding arc would have some effect on this material. Mm-hmm. And always striking out, no effect. So to date, we do not have any successful attempts at breaking this material down, continuously demonstrating the technological advance, mm-hmm, state of this material, that it, even to this day, I would say it would defy conventional explanation.
Wow.
I just thought of another one, Tony.
Yeah, please.
Of new information. And it involves an associate of ours by the name of Anthony Bregaglia, who in our previous book, we offered him a forum to put forth the results of his FOIA requests. And he has a new one in the current book that just came out. And what that involves is, you remember in 2017, this fellow Luis Elizondo put out this video from the fighter aircraft from the USS Nimitz, the Tic Tac video.
Oh, right. Yes.
And that was in 2004, I believe. And so when that happened and the New York Times broke the story that the government all these years, at least from 2007 until 2012, had a $22 million contract to investigate UFOs. And all this time we thought, oh, they don't do that anymore. You know, you see something, you got to report it to the police. No, they had it. They had this this outfit, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, ATIP. Mm-hmm. Well, when Tony saw that, he immediately drafted a FOIA request to the Pentagon. Okay, well, we see this this UFO that you're saying is absolutely, it's not fake, it's real. Tell me where the UFO wreckage that you have is being stored and what tests are you performing upon it? Well, 3 years goes by, Tony doesn't hear anything. He says, okay, I have my team of lawyers warming up in the bullpen. We're going to file suit that so that you comply with my FOIA request. Well, within 2 weeks, he had his answer, and it was more than he expected. It came from the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, under their imprimatur. It said, here's where the wreckage, they call it UAP now. It's not UFO to them. It's UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. Here's where it's at. And here are the tests that are being performed on it. And so help me. The tests are all like cloaking visibility, contracting the speed of light and things like that, all seemingly having to do with space travel from there to here and how they are able to do it, considering the distances involved. And again, I'm not going to tell you where all this stuff is being stored because I want you to buy the book. But we know, and it's in the book, where all of this stuff is being stored and the tests that are being performed on the wreckage. They've since tried to walk it back. Oh, we do lots of tests on metals and think, oh, too late, too late. We already have it under the DIA imprimatur that you do have UFO wreckage, because that's what the FOIA request was talking about. They weren't talking about UAPs. They were talking about UFOs. So here's where it's at, and here are the tests that are being performed on it, and it's in the book.
So it's 75 years. Why do you think after 75 years, this incident is so important to not only to the paranormal community, but to society as a whole? Because some people I talk to, oh, I've heard of it, but what's the big deal? And so for those people that still say, what's the big deal about this? What is your take on that question? Either one.
State that it's, first of all, the granddaddy of all UFO cases, and that it encompasses just about everything what one could want in a UFO investigation. You're talking about physical evidence in the guise of materials, craft, bodies, a survivor. You're talking about all the attempts at reverse engineering. You're talking about multiple military facilities involved, as well as civilians, and all reacting to this as though this indeed was something truly extraordinary. And nothing else, you know, even comes close to this.
Right.
Because whereas all other UFO events are something very fleeting, like the Cheshire Cat, all you have left is the smile. And in the case of, you know, all other UFO events, you may have a landing at the most where you have some swirled grass and depressions in the ground, maybe some broken tree branches, maybe some physiological effects on the eyewitnesses. But beyond that, what do you have as far as that you can actually hold in your hands? And with Roswell, it proved the very existence of the phenomenon overnight.
Right.
If they were to finally, after 75 years, concede Roswell, and I think that's why it's so relevant. And I'm surprised how many of our colleagues haven't picked up on the fact that when the Pentagon report came out last June for the Senate Intel Committee, and they only acknowledged the phenomena back to 2004.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
It's only been a threat to national security for the last, 18 years. What about back to the 60s, the 50s? What about the 40s? Well, the moment they acknowledged the 40s, that would throw up the red flag concerning Roswell. Mm-hmm. Oh, you are conceding that the phenomena goes back to the 40s. Okay, fine. And as one of the congressmen even said, he came out after one of the briefings and he said, if they don't admit Roswell, they're still lying to us. They're right. Still covering this up. And, Tom and I, we've often stated that we could have former presidents, Trump and Carter and Clinton, the late Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, the late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, the former governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, they could all be on your show here tonight, Tony, and they would all lament the fact that they couldn't get the truth about Roswell. And anyone who claims they have that truth, well, they're briefed at a higher level than even the president. I'm sorry. You lose the debate before it even starts, because politics mm-hmm. withstanding, we're in good company. And the point being above all of this, Tony, is that as much as Tom and I are now 100% convinced that Roswell did happen, you're talking about the biggest story of the millennium.
Oh, yeah.
So how can you just, Roswell, we've heard that before. No. We're talking the biggest story in the last 1,000 years. Nothing else comes close to this.
It's, Tony, it's everything that Don just said. And the one thing I would add is that there is no other case that I'm aware of that has hundreds of witnesses. We're not talking about one witness, two witnesses, three. We're talking about hundreds of first and secondhand witnesses who all have a little piece of the story. No witness knows the whole story. In fact, we probably know more than anybody. Mm-hmm. But each one has a little piece, and our mandate was to put these little pieces into a tapestry or a picture that made sense. And that's what we did. But there's no other case. I think like Rendlesham has like 5 witnesses at the most. And the others are, 1 or 2 witnesses. We have literally hundreds. And there's no other case like it. It's the most thoroughly investigated case of all time. And like Don says, the government threw us a curveball when they only went back to 2004. In their so-called investigation.
Mm-hmm.
The way I understood the mandate was that they were supposed to tell us what they knew about UFOs, not just back to 2004, but way back to the beginning. But they threw us, what do they call it? A limited hangout. Is that what they used to call in Watergate? A limited hangout for the public. So that's where we're at.
And I think, this is a very important time in our lives because it's like the World War II. We're getting to the point where there's not a lot of World War II vets left in the world. Most of them are, getting close to 100 years old. And it's the same with Roswell. I mean, are there any eyewitnesses still left? Because the rest of it is just hearsay from family members, children, locals that just kind of heard through other people's mouths. So is there anybody still alive that actually witnessed it?
I would say this, Tony, the ones that we were aware of are all gone.
Mm.
There may be some out there that we were never able to locate or identify. What we did was is we went for the witnesses or the personnel that were on the base that had idiosyncratic names. That would be names that you could identify in a phone book, not Smith or Jones or Williams or something like that. So there may be some still out there that are hanging on that we are unaware of. But of all of the ones that we were ever aware of, they're all gone.
Mm, that's too bad. That's too bad.
But still, fortunately, nobody, as Tom also described, has been able to track down and interview hundreds of these witnesses. And as a result, the picture that they have painted for
I'm
us
sure.
is 100% unanimous in that we are dealing with a craft that was manufactured off the planet.
Mm-hmm.
There are no witnesses to the original weather balloon. There are certainly no witnesses to Project Mogul, the third explanation. And heaven help us if there were witnesses to the crash dummies, which didn't originate until 1952, 5 years after the incident, Project High Dive and Project Excelsior. So that's a non-secular, to begin with.
Right.
So the government is batting zero thus far. And we're the ones that as judges, as attorneys have told both of us, we could take this into any court of law and win hands down.
Wow. And I think if anybody can do it, you two probably be the ones that could get that done. One thing, Don, you said earlier about, presidents, when they come into office, a lot of them do. They ask, tell me about, are UFOs real? And, we don't know what they've been told and the security clearances, if they've been threatened, if they've been said it's national security, so don't let people know that you know. But Tom, you were a United States Air Force vet and had top secret clearance. While you're in the military, did you ever is that what kind of piqued your interest with Roswell, or is what really kind of drove you to this, knowledge of Roswell itself? And did you ask questions while you were in the military?
Good question. No, when I was in the military, I'd never heard of Roswell.
Oh, wow.
And my interest in the UFOs, as a matter of fact, during my military career was not on my radar. I became aware of Roswell when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto in Ontario, Canada. I belonged to QFORN, the Canadian UFO Research Network, as a sideline. And one of the gentlemen in that group, this is 1977-78, he says, "Oh, there's a book coming out on Roswell." I said, "What's a Roswell?" And he said, "Oh, that's a big story about a crash." I said, "Oh, wow, I can't wait for that." Well, anyway, the book comes out in 1980. I purchased it, I read it, and it blew me away, Tony. My interest in all other UFO cases at that point disappeared. This was the only case, like Paul Newman says in the movie The Verdict, this is the case. This is the only case. And at that point, that was it for me. And there were these two fellas at QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, mm-hmm. one Kevin Randall, the other one on this show tonight, who were reopening the Roswell case. And so I hooked up with them because I wanted to do something on the case. And that's how I became interested, and that's how I became an active participant with the Randall Schmidt team.
And you, Don, you were what, co-director? Is that right, of the institute?
I was a co-director, and I was director of special investigations for 10 years. And this was the one case we wanted to go after because both of us were skeptics. I did not even purchase the book when it first came out. And in fact, in 1985, 5 years after its release, I had even written a paper where I argued that something of that magnitude, you know, couldn't be kept secret, that it would certainly have leaked out by now. And like many of our colleagues, it was just too good to be true. The idea that we actually managed to capture, you know, recover a saucer. And one of the people that, you know, has often gone unsung, who was a tremendous influence and friend in all this, was the late Leonard Stringfield. And he had even done a presentation in Dayton, Ohio, just a couple years before the Roswell incident was published. And he was already creating a list of witnesses, not only the Roswell, but other potential events, other crashes that happened subsequently since 1947. And so Stringfield was a tremendous source of information and motivation, in that people went to him strictly because he was a man of his word. He retained their confidentiality. He published their accounts, but kept them anonymous. But he did share information with us. And as a result, it only enabled us to track down other witnesses, other members of a particular flight, for example, where we were able to not only get a manifest, we were able to, you know, confirm specific details, the strange circumstances about the flights, for example, and how it just all kept falling into this scenario that something big had happened. The base was under lockdown at Roswell, that there were entire areas that were off limits to base personnel. There were all types of outside units that came in, including the base hospital, with doctors and nurses who were flown in, suggesting that there was more than just materials involved. And so it just continued to demonstrate that not only were we wrong in our original assessment that this couldn't have happened, but after our first trip in February of 1989, we couldn't get back down to New Mexico fast enough. We were back down in April, and we were back down in June. And so, in other words, we realized that we were potentially dealing with something so big that we better treat it as though it was something important. Otherwise, it would just blow us away. We'd get caught with our pants down, and we'd never recover.
Yeah, and I know, Tom, you said you've interviewed a lot of the people that either witnessed it or kind of through the military maybe got to see some of the wreckage. But can you give us one of the most compelling, like, deathbed confessions that that really blew your mind? Because, you know, there's a lot of times, like I said, I always give the example. I'm from Kansas. My dad, you know, and all of us, we were hunters and fishers. And, you know, they caught a fish and, you know, it was a pound and a half. And then by 3 or 4 years, it was 6 pound bass. And, you know, the stories just keep getting bigger and bigger. But one, tell us a story that maybe that just really put that, the goose pimples or goosebumps on your arm when you heard it.
Well, it's for me, it wasn't one that I conducted. It was one that Kevin Randall conducted, and it was early on. And I thought it was a very important deathbed confession, because at the time, I think it was 1989, 90, 91, in that time frame. This was before I even joined the team. The base provost marshal was a fellow, Major Edwin Easley. And Kevin was interviewing Edwin Easley. And now Easley would have been in charge of the MPs that surrounded the crash site, kept it secure. He knew everything. He knew everything, most everything. And so Kevin calls him up on the telephone, and he wants to interview Easley and get information. And to every question that Kevin asked him, Easley would say, "I'm sorry, I'm sworn to secrecy. I can't tell you anything." Every question, "I can't tell you anything. I'm sworn to secrecy." Well, Kevin this was like a throwaway question. Finally, as the interview was ending, he says, well, can you tell us if Don Schmidt and I are going in the right direction? And Easley says, well, what do you mean? He says, well, whether it's a UFO or something else. And so there's a long pause. And Easley finally says, well, let me say this. You're not going in the wrong direction, meaning that they were going in the right direction, that it was a UFO. And I thought that at that point in time was very important. He also, on his literal deathbed at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, the book that Randall and Schmidt wrote, one of his grandchildren brought it into Easley, who's on his deathbed, and she says, what about this, Grandpa? What about this, Grandpa? So she holds the book up. I think it was UFO Crash at Roswell. and he goes, oh, the creatures.
Oh,
talking
wow.
about the bodies. So there you got, he confesses to the reality of Roswell and the fact that there were occupants, dead occupants. So for me, that's the important deathbed confession.
I mean, that's
yeah. About that is that at the hospital, it was in 1992.
92?
It was in the presence of his two daughters,
right,
as well, the granddaughter. And the one daughter, Nancy Strickland, she's a practicing attorney. So we can't emphasize enough that deathbeds are admissible in a court of law. So she would have been able to testify, even secondhand, as to that very statement. And that Easley went on to then also apologize that it was the president who had asked them never to say another word about this, that he so regretted that he couldn't share the details of what had actually happened with his very family. But please understand, I took an oath. But as Tom mentioned, just by that reaction, oh, the creatures, says it all. I mean, my God, it wasn't like, oh, the neoprene rubber. I'm sorry.
Do you feel like this incident in Roswell is what really started the change in the space race? Because if you think about it, we went from 0 to 1,000 when it comes to technology in just a very short amount of time. You know, at the beginning of the 19th century, we had horse and buggy. Till the end of the century, we're flying into outer space. Do you think this was the technology that we retrieved that changed our technology?
We get that question all the time.
I'm sure.
And I'll be honest with you, I don't like it. Because a lot of, military conflict like World War II spawned a lot of different projects that led to this and that and the other thing. And the only one the thing that I'm certain of, it came from Roswell. Well, there's two things. One I'm certain, the other one I'm guessing that there's a good chance. The one that a good chance is fiber optics. Because some of the wreckage that was found, it mimics, or we're mimicking it. It was fiber optics.
Hmm.
The other one is something, the memory metal, which was a lot of the wreckage. A lot of the wreckage was this so-called memory metal that you could wad it up in your hand and let it go, and it would unfurl itself and just float there in the air, and you couldn't bend it permanently or crease it permanently or cut it or burn it, stuff like that. So that was one of the first things that the Air Force wanted to try to back engineer, and they did that at out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Battelle Memorial Institute was just down the road in Columbus. So they gave the contract to Battelle Memorial to try to back engineer this, what we call memory metal. And it took years and years. And Battelle didn't like their name being associated with flying saucers or UFOs and things like that. So they formed it out to be announced to the world as Nitinol. They gave it to the Naval Ordnance Lab in Maryland. Here, you guys announce it. We don't want to announce this. And they worked on it. It was a combination of titanium and nickel. And it's the best attempt at trying to back engineer the memory metal. It's used in the space program.
Right.
It's used all over the place. But it's not as good as the original. It's not as good as the original because you can cut it, and, you know, because you can buy it in the by the roll. You can buy it by the coil. You can buy it by the sheet. But it's our best attempt at improvising it to the memory metal. But the NI stands for nickel, the TI stands for titanium, and the NOL stands for Naval Ordnance Lab. It was announced in 1962, the development of Nitinol. You can look it up on your, put it in your browser and look it up and see what it looks like. But it came from the Roswell crash, I believe.
That's great. No, that's great how you explain that. So and that kind of actually leads me to the next question, as in, you know, we're talking about taking the pieces of the wreckage and, you know, fire or the it wouldn't even be affected by the what is it called?
Blast furnace.
The furnace. So
yeah, blast.
So my question is, if it's so resilient to resistance to fire and all this other stuff, how did it even break up once it crashed? If it was so strong, you wouldn't think it would make that many pieces in the wreckage.
When we've worked with crash investigators, and when you have a pattern of debris, mm-hmm. in this particular case that is scattered for almost a mile, it is consistent with when Major Jesse Marcel, the head of intelligence of the 509th at Roswell, when they first arrived on the scene, his first impression was not only he could not believe the vast amount of debris, but then secondly, that it clearly was a mid-air explosion.
It
was something that had exploded at some altitude, thus raining debris that covered such a wide swath of territory. And if that being the case, we've confirmed, and we also had ranchers who described a severe lightning storm during that time. Ranchers described that between the thunderclaps they heard what sounded like an explosion. And so it's easy to then surmise that maybe this was an object that was struck by lightning. And then you have others who have suggested that because the radar lobes between Alamogordo at mm-hmm. White Sands and at Kirtland in Albuquerque, and there was a radar facility in Vaughan, there was another facility west of Magdalena in conjunction with the rocket launches of the captured V2 rockets after World War II, that these radar lobes all intersected
mm-hmm.
directly in that county. So it's been suggested that because radar was in its infancy at that time, that maybe it jammed their guidance system, that it had some ill effect on their craft. So again, all speculation on our part. We don't know. And I don't know that they ever determined exactly what caused the crash. But regarding to your basic question, how did it break up if it was that nearly indestructible?
Right.
We have to concede, for example, that our materials, our composites, our alloys of the combination of different elements back in 1947 maybe was at this level at one point. And then here today in 2022, we've risen to a much higher level, that there's consistent progress as to lighter and stronger materials. So in other words, our fracture point continues to rise. Given that this was an assembled craft,
mm-hmm.
that it has to be malleable at some point, just as our own, and that its fracture point was much higher than anything that we have been able to develop. But whatever caused it to break up reached that point. It reached that fracture point. And again, we don't know what the cause was. We don't, but it reached that point of just disintegration.
Mm.
And as a result, the materials still were beyond anything, even by today's standards, of anything that we have.
Yeah. I mean, it would almost make sense that it was internal, because especially of our technology back then, I wouldn't think it would even be able to pierce it. Our weapons. So, but, you know, that's, like you said, we don't know exactly what happened. I'm curious to ask also, was there any illnesses or sicknesses, you know, because it's like when, you know, Europeans came to America and they passed on, you know, smallpox to the native people. Were there any type of illnesses that people that came in contact with the wreckage or, you know, that people spoke of?
The only thing that I'm aware of, Tony, is that there was a higher incidence of cancer in Roswell than in the larger population. And that's most likely attributable that it was an atomic base. It had the atom bombs were stored there.
Right.
As far as what you're asking, I think you're asking, were there any illnesses due to the
exposure to the aliens,
the craft and the bodies?
Yeah.
And the only story I'm aware of, maybe Don is aware of another one, was a fellow by the name of Barney Barnett, who was an agricultural engineer living in Magdalena. And he told of a story very similar to Roswell. And we think that if that story was true, it wasn't the same year as Roswell, but maybe 3 years later, but where he discovered a crashed craft with bodies hanging around dead outside. And he died of throat cancer a few years later. And according to his neighbor, a fellow named Harold Baca, Barney told him that he felt that his throat cancer was due to getting too close to one of the dead alien bodies. Now, that's just a story. It has nothing to do with Roswell, but actually that story was featured in the Roswell incident book when they were trying to link the planes of St. Augustine alleged crash as the Roswell crash. But that's the only one I can think of.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean,
I'll add to that. The men clearly felt they were handling materials that were potentially contaminated.
Right.
And that as a result, they wanted to get the job done, especially those who were part of the recovery operation. They were spooked by it. They felt that, you know, it was something that they would pay for either sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
First Lieutenant Chester Barton described that when they would return back to the base, that they were first to report to the hospital, the base hospital, suggesting that they were also monitoring the health of the individuals involved. And yet they were very laissez-faire as far as the recovery. They weren't wearing decon outfits of any sort. Right. They were handling it with bare hands.
Mm.
They weren't wearing goggles or any face coverings, face masks or anything. And I think that's often the case with the military, where they're expendable. They're treated very often as guinea pigs, and it's like they're the grunts. They're the ones on their hands and knees picking up every piece. And the first ones to sample if there should be any ill effects.
Yeah.
That just triggered a story that there was this one fellow who was part of the recovery team, according to his wife. He came home at night smelling like a skunk, and he immediately burned his fatigues that you know, he was wearing when they were doing their recovery. He burned them in the backyard, and he took several showers every day for 2 weeks because he felt unclean at handling this material. And I guess eventually he got over it, but burning his clothes and taking multiple showers daily. Also, there was another one where a flight, and I can't remember the fellow's name, a flight that taking the bodies from Fort Worth back to Wright Field, they had the bodies in like a, they said the container looked like a large thermos jug. And maybe Don can remember the fellow's name. I can't remember it.
The last name was Tiffany.
Tiffany, that's right. And the he said that the fellas on that flight, they were beside themselves with feeling some close to something that they just felt was unearthly. They just had a bad sense about it. I don't know if they felt sick or not, but they were really affected by it, being so close to something that came from someplace else.
Our time is getting limited, and I can't believe it's gone this fast. But before we go, I kind of want to know, it would be hard to believe to keep the bodies and the wreckage in the same place, just due to security reasons. Did they keep the bodies and the wreckage in the same place, or did they, that you've heard of, did they separate the two, and whatever happened to the bodies that you have heard of?
Well, as we mentioned initially, everything transited through one specific B-29 hangar, P-3,
right.
Roswell. And it's basically where you keep everything in one location, like intact, under lock and key. You don't spread things out any more than you need to.
Right.
There were multiple flights that did transport the remains, the wreckage, even the craft. But at the beginning, even though we know that a number of flights went to Fort Worth, going up the chain of command, the 8th Air Force, where the base commander at Roswell, Colonel William Blanchard's boss, General Roger Ramey, was located. And so, but the final destination, at least back at that time, was all Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
And Wright Field was, where you had Foreign Technology Division, where they did all the reverse engineering of all captured weaponry and armory, for example, after World War II. If you had so much as a Russian MiG, it all went to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson, as it eventually became in January of 48. So in other words, if you had something truly foreign, as it was in this case, all roads led to Dayton, Ohio. There was no Area 51 back at that time. Right. 51 didn't even come into existence until 55. So again, that's another one of the smoke screens, the rumors that have become part of the folklore that were never part of this story from the very beginning.
We have a deathbed confession from a former head of FTD, the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson. On his bed, he said where the bodies were. It's in the book where the bodies are being stored. And as I told you before, we believe, we learned from someone who worked at FTD and at Wright Field that the wreckage was transferred from Wright-Patterson to Area 51 at some point in the 1980s. And then it started, Area 51 started getting a publicity, and there was a lawsuit for hazardous material. And so they moved it to the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah for a while. And so from there, they went to where we know that the wreckage is today. So, and they are separated. We know the bodies, or last we heard, were at... well, it's in the book.
I was going to say, don't say it, Tom. Don't say it. Well, gentlemen, I time is up, and I hate to say that. We're going to have you back, but definitely I'll see you both in Roswell for the 75th anniversary.
Roswell, yes, very good.
Yeah, we're going to be down there.
Tom a question, he'll answer, it's in the book.
Well, congratulations, though.
I never thought I'd do that.
Right? You're a good plugger, which that's what a good PR rep would tell you, plug the book. As you can see it on the screen, Witness to Roswell, 75th anniversary edition. It's hard to believe it's 75 years, but how do people find out? Do you have a website, social media? Can you tell us where to find you on social media or where to website? Anything?
Well, we're both on Facebook under our names, but the website was hacked and it's in the process of being rebuilt. You'll never guess who.
It's in the book? No kidding.
It's a company in China. It's a casino gambling, you know, site. But the books are certainly available at Barnes & Noble. I'll find bookstores throughout the country and certainly at Amazon.
Perfect.
And all the other books. That how many books have we done now together all the time? 7?
12.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. Right. I'm thinking 7 bestsellers.
We've had 7 bestsellers. But this is our 12th book together. Wow. Yeah, about Roswell.
Congratulations. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work. And thank you for doing all the work so people like myself don't have to.
Well, and if it turns out, the government as well, because so often I'm sure they went, my God, we didn't know about that witness. We didn't know about that one. And so
I'm like, sure they bought the book. I'm sure they bought the book. Well, thank you both so much for being part of Truth Be Told, and I can't wait to see you both in Roswell. So people, make your reservations. It's a great time. I was there for the 70th anniversary, did some interviews, got to see the parade. It's a pretty fun time just to enjoy, you know, being around people that love the UFO community like all of us here. So,
and it's history this year. 75th anniversary.
75th.
So. It's glad you're going to be there to be part of it, Tony.
Oh, I'm excited. No, I'm glad to be there myself. So, but thank you both, and hopefully you'll come back and join us again.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you everybody for joining. Truth Be Told. Be sure to subscribe. I know people are loving this show. Share this. Leave comments. It always helps us. Listen to our podcast, all from iHeart and all that good stuff. But until then, next time on Truth Be Told, see you next Friday. Bye. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.